Always so good to have you all here. The 12 days of Christmas end with Epiphany. It's always on January 6th, which will be Tuesday. In the traditional church, it signifies the arrival of the wise men to worship the child Jesus. They recognized the divinity in him and the importance of his birth to the world. So Epiphany commemorates a revelation. It's not much of a holiday anymore. Apparently, it used to be like Mardi Gras. Wild revelry and disorder. Shakespeare's play, Twelfth Night, was written as entertainment for the close of the Christmas season. In our language today, an epiphany is a moment when we suddenly see or understand something in a new way. Our awareness of the divine within us is often an epiphany. It's a realization that we are so much more than personality. So all through December, we've said Christmas represents the birth of the Christ Spirit in us, our own divinity. It's a greater level of spiritual awareness than we've ever known before. And it begins as a glimmer, a baby, and it is brought forth and nurtured through our intuition and our willingness to be guided. So I didn't want to leave Christmas this year without talking about the wise men and what they mean for us today, because they kind of wrap up the story. Although we would have a perfectly good Christmas story without them, it just adds a whole new layer of mysticism. And I have a minister friend who says, the mystery of the Bible is in the bit players. So let me read you the story, because sometimes it's hard to remember what the Bible actually says and what's just been added through the years. In the time of King Herod, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem asking, "Where is the child who has been born king of the Jews? For we observed his star at its rising and have come to pay him homage." When King Herod heard this, he was frightened, and all Jerusalem with him. And calling together all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Messiah was to be born. And they told him, "In Bethlehem of Judea, for so it has been written by the prophet." Then Herod secretly called for the wise men and learned from them the exact time when the star had appeared. Then he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, "Go and search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring me word so that I may also go and pay homage." When they'd heard the king, they set out, and there ahead of them went the star that they had seen at its rising, until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw that the star had stopped, they were overwhelmed with joy. On entering the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they knelt down and paid him homage. Then, opening their treasure chests, they offered him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they left for their own country by another road. This story is only in the book of Matthew, which was written about 50 years after Jesus' entire life. Luke's version of the Christmas story has the shepherds instead. You know, only two Gospels have a birth story, and they're different. We've conflated them. In the context of these verses, it appears that the wise men came when Jesus was probably about 2 years old. He was not still in that stable lying in a manger. In the book of Matthew, Mary and Joseph lived in Bethlehem, and Jesus was just born at their house. Notice what it doesn't say. It never says three wise men. It never says they were kings. There's nothing about riding camels. They were not given names, although the church much later assigned names to them: Caspar, Melchior, and Balthazar. In our nativity scenes, we also like to imagine that they were one of each race, white, black, and Asian. We keep embellishing it through the years. But it was never intended to be a literal story. It wove together old and new. You remember when Jewish writers were trying to convey the spiritual significance of a person or event, they tied it to something that was already in their scriptures, what we would call the Old Testament. The process is called Midrash. And the writer of Matthew did this. He even points it out in several places. and his Jewish audience would have recognized those references. So when you look back in the Hebrew Bible to Isaiah 60, it says, "Kings shall come to the brightness of God's rising." Kings and brightness rising. Then it says, "They will come on camels." Then it says, "They will bring gold and frankincense." Matthew added myrrh. Everyone who came from the East brought spices, and myrrh was the best known spice in the Middle East. It was sweet smelling tree resin. They used it mostly in burials when the body was wrapped in a shroud as perfume. So adding myrrh to Matthew's story foreshadowed Jesus' death. These wise men were magi. The word magic and magician comes from that. They were astrologers and astronomers, which was the same thing at the time. They were alchemists. They were spiritual seekers. They were us. Yet when we hear there's a great speaker or a workshop somewhere or a spiritual leader with a new message, we'll travel to find it. So these men left their home in the East. Today that would be Iraq, Iran, Yemen, Saudi Arabia. For Jews in Israel, the East signified stranger danger. Something different and unknown would be coming from the East. And their enemies are still to the East. The wise men were willing to follow a star, this glimmer of understanding that there was more to life than they had known. So let's talk about that star. They had no concept of outer space or galaxies. They studied the stars, but they didn't know what they were looking at. They thought stars were lanterns that God hung in the sky. So, of course, God could move them around to guide you if necessary. They didn't know they were looking back in time through light years. If God wanted a star to guide them to Jesus, he would have had to start millions of years in advance. Notice the wise men are the only ones who can see the star. Herod can't see it. He is frantically trying to find out where the baby is. And Herod is us too, I'm afraid. He represents the ego, the frightened parts of us that are threatened by anything new, especially if it's powerful. Herod was afraid this child they were calling king of the Jews would take his throne. The ego tries to stamp out the birth of divine awareness. It says things like, "This stuff is woo-woo. You're going to look foolish. You don't have time to go to church. Who are all these weird people? They're trying to hug you." Or things like that. Herod the Great was a real historical figure. He was the king of the Jews. He was the king of Judea on behalf of the Roman Empire. He murdered a great many people, including some of his family. But he died probably before or about the same time Jesus was born. So he really couldn't have been part of this story. But the name Herod would strike fear in the hearts of the audience. The wise men continued to follow the star. They found the baby. They gave their gifts. Then they were warned in a dream not to go back to Herod. And Herod was furious. Ego had a tantrum. And as the story continues, Joseph is told in a dream to take the toddler Jesus and flee to Egypt because Herod is looking for him. Herod goes on to kill all the baby boys under two around Bethlehem. Finally, Joseph is told in another dream that it's safe to go home a couple of years later, but not to Judea. Still another dream warns him away, so he takes the family to Nazareth instead. There are a lot of dreams here. Remember, Joseph was first told in a dream that Mary's baby was from the Holy Spirit. Then he dreamed he should flee Herod, then he dreamed he could go back. The wise men dreamed not to go back to Herod. Charles Fillmore, Unity's co-founder, believed that men in the Bible always represent the thinking, rational side of human beings, and women represent the feeling side. It's not about gender. We all have both sides. But Joseph and Mary are thinking and feeling. They are espoused to each other, like it or not. For a while, remember, Joseph wanted to get rid of Mary. Have you ever tried to divorce your feelings? you're stuck with each other. So Joseph had to go to sleep and dream to connect with his intuition. He had to put the thinking, rational side to sleep. And that's what we do. That's what we simulate with meditation, quieting the mind so we can receive clearly. You have to give Joseph and the wise men credit for trusting the guidance in their dreams. They were indeed wise. Charles Fillmore said the wise men represent the wisdom that is carried within the soul from previous incarnations. It's what we brought with us. And even in our forgetful human state, that wisdom sees the star and follows the guiding light, even if we don't know where it's leading. And it has gifts for us, blessings, powers, abilities. Wisdom is spiritual intuition, the voice of God within as the source of our understanding. It's judgment and discernment. It's everything that goes into knowing. Knowing beyond intellectual information. The intellect has to go to sleep sometimes. Wisdom and understanding come from the Spirit of Christ within us, our own divinity. Wisdom and understanding are two of our 12 divine powers. But to receive it, we have to let go of the personal self with its limited beliefs, our inner Herod. Ego wants to be an only child, wants to destroy the new baby. The wise men were intuitive enough not to let Herod know where the baby was. And Herod never found him. Soul wisdom prevailed. This is the point where I usually ask, so what does this mean for us in our lives today? But you already see yourself in the story, don't you? It's about overcoming the worst aspects of personality, fear in particular, the Herod parts of us, and following guidance to divine awareness wherever it leads, the wise man part of us. It's about protecting your new understanding, as Joseph protected the baby, and giving it a chance to thrive. So I'll ask a different question. If this story is about recognizing the divine in you, what prevents that? What keeps you from knowing who you truly are? Because here's the thing. The star is always shining. You only have to follow the light. So what keeps you from setting out on that journey sometimes? I'm going to make one suggestion for what often keeps us from seeing the light, and that is unforgiveness. Holding on to grudges, anger, and hurts that only exist in our human experience, our Herod mind. Last week, we launched what I am calling 99 Days of Forgiveness, which will run till Easter, and you groaned. And I've been thinking all week about why you groaned. We're already down to 92 days. So for the next 92 days, I am planning to insist over and over that forgiveness is the most freeing thing you can do for yourself. It leads to peace and understanding within you. It frees your energy, physically and emotionally. I know it's hard work because it brings up unhappy memories. But they're already in there, festering. That's why it feels so dark and heavy. So it might be worth it to look at them full on one more time in order to let them go. Forgiveness can be such hard work, sometimes we call it the F word. But forgive in Greek means untie the knot. I like thinking I'm going to untie some knots in myself. And of course, that clears space for more good. How much space do you think unforgiveness is taking up in you? So my plan is to talk about forgiveness on the first Sundays in February and March. It's potluck, so I figure you'll come hear about forgiveness even if you're groaning. In February, I plan a longer than usual meditation about forgiveness and letting go that's been really powerful for me. But in the meantime, I have one simple daily exercise for you if you choose to participate in this forgiveness operation. You don't have to, but everyone else will end up happy and you'll still be mad about something. So So this little exercise is from Mary Morrissey, who teaches our big prosperity classes. Forgiveness is a huge part of prosperity because it makes room for abundance to receive. So every morning when you get up, you can do this in meditation or while you're brushing your teeth. Ask, who or what do I need to forgive today? And just see what pops into your mind. The first few days might be obvious people and events, but after a week or 10 days, it'll start to get interesting. I keep thinking I'm pretty clear with forgiveness. I've done work on my parents and my exes. And then I remember how I feel about certain political parties or news networks or waiters or store clerks, and the list becomes long pretty fast. What pops up for you might be an old wound or just some irritating thing that happened yesterday. You might want to keep a list as you go to see if anything recurs. So once you have someone or something in mind, then what do? How exactly do you forgive? No one knows. Truly, they've done studies on this, and no one can say for sure what really leads to forgiveness, what allows you to finally let go. Personally, I believe the key is willingness. Just be willing to forgive, and eventually you will realize you have forgiven. Call it grace. The energy around the memories will be gone. You'll be able to think of the person or event without feeling anything in particular. Remember the first time I talked to my ex-husband and there was no knot in my stomach. Just kind of nothing. I loved it. You can make up affirmations. One that I've used a lot is, I release you to your happy life and I take back mine. You can ask the angels to cut the energetic cords between you. Archbishop Desmond Tutu says there are four steps in forgiveness, and I'll talk about them later. I'm really enjoying his book, The Book of Forgiveness, Book of Forgiving, which we may or may not have in the bookstore. It's coming. Our thoughts keep us stirred up. If you can move the idea of forgiveness from your head to your heart, it might feel different. Because when you groan about forgiveness, it's based on what you're thinking. What happens when it enters the heart? Do you really want to release and be free? Maybe not immediately, but when the heart says yes, you are ready to let go. Hafez, our Sufi poet, says, forgiveness is the cash you need. All other kinds of silver really buy just strange things. Forgiveness is part of the treasure you need to craft your falcon wings and return to your true realm of divine freedom. So let's take those thoughts into meditation. In meditation, we simply relax and become comfortable. You might want to close your eyes or take a deep, relaxing breath. And turn within. Let everything else go. The holidays we've been through, the year to come. And just turn within. Somewhere in you, there is a rising star. It is the divine in you, and it is your soul's journey. It guides you through this human experience. So see if you can imagine the star in you. It might be in your heart, your head, wherever your soul resides. It might be filling your whole body, this light of divinity in you. It's there all the time. And your only job is to clear the way for it to shine. But that might require some letting go of the past, the anger, the hurts that still linger. Letting go of whatever no longer serves you. All it takes is willingness. Are you willing to be free? The light in you is your guiding star. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness cannot overcome it. So, to clear out some darkness, bring to mind someone or some event that you know you need to forgive, to let go of. You're tired of it hanging around. Tired of the way you feel? Are you willing to be free? As you hold this image in your mind, just say, if you're ready, I am willing to forgive. Let's say that together. I am willing to forgive. Whatever it is, whatever happened, we do this over and over in our lives. But we live in a state of willingness to forgive and to set ourselves free. We're so grateful to know what we can do to follow the star. And we say, thank you, God. Amen.